Thank you for tuning in to Hacks and Hobbies with your host, Junaid. We're visited by our amazing guests coming from all walks of life. We want to learn their story, their struggles, and their journey on how they got to where they are today. So stick around. Welcome back to Hacks and Hobbies. I'm your host, Junaid, and today I'm thrilled to bring on a powerhouse from the publishing world, Tom Freiling. With over 100 million in publishing revenue, multiple New York Times best-selling authors under his wing, and a front row seat to the transformation of the publishing industry. Tom brings 30 plus years of insight, strategy, and storytelling wisdom to this conversation. And if you've been wondering how AI fits into the future of books, or why your most human qualities matter more than ever, well, this episode is for you. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Junaid, thank you. It's great to be back with you. Good to see you again.
100%. Now, people might be wondering, what do you mean welcome back? Well, the fun thing is we had an amazing conversation on our live stream on Hacks and Hobbies Live. You can find it on LinkedIn and YouTube and Facebook in the next 30 days. But Tom, I'm so glad we connected through PodMatch. You've been at the helm of traditional and digital publishing for decades. What first drew you into the world of books?
It's a great question. I can't say I intentionally meant to be a book publisher. I fell into a telemarketing job many years ago, almost 30 years ago, selling books to bookstores. So it was an accident, honestly, but I fell in love with the industry almost immediately. I have always loved books. I think you, I'm sure you do as well. Mm-hmm. Many of us do. But I just fell in love with the work. I like to hear people's stories. I like to read people's stories. And I mostly like to help other people tell their stories. So it didn't take me long to figure out that I loved it. And here we are almost 30 years later, and I'm still doing it.
That's so awesome. What's funny is that my first telemarketing job was selling subscriptions to a free catalog to people in a list. So I would call them up like, hey, would you like to continue receiving this publication to buy educational material on Islam? And they were like, yes, please continue. And then other times they would say no. And the reason I remember this is because on occasion I called the president of the company who's also on the same list, like, hey, would you like to continue? And it's like, wait, this is my company that you're scheduling for. Like, so I was like, that was interesting. But that was, again, many, many years ago, almost 30 as well. But I didn't stick around in that space, and I'm glad that I'm here getting to talk to you about book publishing. Now, Tom, was there a defining book that pulled you into this journey? You fell into it on accident as a telemarketing job, selling books to bookstores. But was there one specific book that says, oh my God, I want to continue doing this?
I don't know that there's one specific book. If I had to point to any, it might be Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Oh my God.
Which was, you know, deeply impactful. Many people have read the book, of course. So I think that probably impacted me more than any other book I've read. Mm-hmm. But I have a short list. I could probably go on and on. My short list would probably become a long list if I started thinking about it. The one thing about Frankl's book that always struck me was that it was a very short book. Off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how many pages it was, but it was not even 200 pages. Mm-hmm. But he was able to deliver a very impactful message in it. You know, a few amount of words.
Yeah.
That surprised me that could be done. And even today, I recommend that authors write short books and not drone on and on. Mm-hmm. You want to deliver your message in as few words as possible, actually. That's the goal, at least.
That's a very powerful goal, Tom. And as you're talking about Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, what's interesting and it occurs to me is there's a saying or there's something that happened, and this this gentleman is writing a letter. And it's a really long letter. And he says, you know, I didn't have enough time, so I wrote you this long letter. If I had more time, it'd be much shorter.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And Viktor Frankl spent so much time in seclusion and, you know, where he was during the Holocaust and whatnot. So it makes sense that he was able to concise and, you know, spent so much time writing. And, yeah. And in this day and age, we have so little time that we write so much content. And, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, we need to write a lot less. We need to be more concise because people's attention span is, again, something that's lacking.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, I would say also that, yes, his story, living through the Holocaust, it is tragic. It's a compelling story, of course. Mm-hmm. And he learned a lot from that and through that. And he communicated what he learned in a way that helps the reader confront what they're dealing with. I don't think many of us are ever going to have to endure something like the Holocaust, but mm-hmm. we all endure some pretty tough stuff throughout our lives.
Yes, we do.
You know, there's a lot of trauma and tragedy out there. And when you can, when you meet somebody who has gone through something else that's really hard, that's helpful, you know?
Yeah.
So, and the great thing about books is that you can find people through books who you don't know, who you'll never meet, who've experienced the same things that you are experiencing now. They've already experienced it. Yeah. And you can glean so much from that, and you will probably never meet the author, right? We rarely meet the authors that we read,
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter. They're still helping you. Yes. And sometimes you honestly feel like you become their friend. You'll finish writing a book and you'll feel like they're your friend, even though you'll never actually meet them. So I think I think it's an incredible thing that can happen when you read a book.
You're absolutely right. You build this parasocial association with the person who wrote the book. I've read Bob, can't remember his name, but he wrote the Go Giver series. Amazing story set, and I feel like I know who Bob is, right? The author. And it's just fascinating how that still holds today.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go back to publishing, Tom.
Okay.
So you've been in this space for so long. What was publishing like in the early days compared to what it is now, where people are, you know, pushing out books left and right, thanks to the technologies that we have now?
It was different. It was very different. There were a lot less books being published 20, 30 mm-hmm. years ago. And a significantly less books than now, a lot less books. So that was very different. There wasn't as many books to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest difference was that the bookstores were the gatekeepers in the old days.
Yeah.
I call them the old days, but they truly were. The bookstores and the bookstore owners, they were really deciding what we read, because it was the only place to get a book, was a bookstore or a library.
That's right.
So they were the gatekeepers, and you'd walk into a bookstore and you'd see books on the shelf. They were vetted by the bookstores. And when a book was on the bookshelf in the bookstore, that told you, well, this is probably a pretty good book because the bookstore chose to sell the book, mm-hmm. right? So that was meaningful to the readers. So in a large part, the bookstores were deciding what they wanted us to read.
Mm.
That's changed a lot. First of all, we don't visit bookstores very often. I love bookstores, but there's not as many, so you just don't go as often.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just been kind of removed. Now, when you go to Amazon, it's a very different buying experience. When you're in a bookstore, you walk up and down the shelves, pull books off the shelf, you browse maybe for an hour,
mm-hmm.
and you discover all these books that you didn't even know existed. And you might walk into a bookstore intending to buy one book, but then you leave with another book or maybe five books.
Yeah.
Well, the experience on Amazon is completely different. You don't have that ability to walk up and down aisles and quickly and easily browse the bookshelves.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when you go to Amazon, you kind of know what you're looking for. Sometimes very specifically, you know what you're going to look for.
Mm-hmm.
So in Amazon has enabled a lot more authors to get published. There's a lot more books on the market. But it's harder to discover the books than it used to be when they were in the bookstore.
So true.
So there's been good and bad, I think.
You bring up a really good point about there's a lot less way to get discovered on through because the model that's available, right, through the bookstore or through Amazon and through other book sites that you, even if you know about them. And I think that's one of the reasons why Amazon bestseller lists or New York Times bestseller lists are so prominent. They're doing the same job, kind of, what the bookstores were doing in the past. They're like, hey, these are the books that we think are the best ones, and you can then count on somebody else making that decision for you.
That is true. We because there are so many books now, we kind of lack the ability to know if a book has been vetted by anybody, except for
Correct.
the author, right? So when it lands on a bestsellers list, this book has been vetted by the readers themselves.
Yes, the
And
readers have
that's
spoken.
obviously very meaningful. And most of us make these days, we make a lot of buying decisions based on reviews.
Yes, we do.
When I travel and if I'm looking for a hotel, then I look at the reviews for that hotel, right? That's how I make my decisions in large part. It's the same with books. We make a lot of our decisions based on the reviews. Some books will have thousands of reviews, and that means a lot. If a book only has two reviews, well, that means something, right? It means the readers have not vetted this book yet. So you're taking a risk on buying that book.
It's so true. And as we're talking about books, Alex Hormozi did a really wonderful job of getting countless number of reviews on his book. His third book is actually coming out in a week, and the ads that he's running for his book launch has been really, really interesting. Now, Tom, you built a company from scratch that was eventually acquired by a NASDAQ-listed media firm, and that's rare air in any industry, let alone publishing. What were the key levers for that kind of scale, and that helped you, or that helped them say, "Hey, this is the company we want to purchase"?
It was early on in the digital publishing space. So in that particular case, I was on the front end of something, and I can't say that it was intentional. A lot of people looking back will say, "Well, that was intentional. I meant to do that." I don't know that that's the case. So there was a certain amount of luck involved, I think, being one of the first, one of the first to the table. So that was in part, I think in anytime you start a business, if you're on the front end of something, that's helpful, right? So we were at the front end of it.
The first mover's advantage, they call it, right?
So that was important for us. But I mean, I hopefully, I mean, I believe that we built a strong company. It was a bootstrap operation. I never brought on any investors or any debt. And that forced me to be smart about the decisions that I made. Looking back, well, I've been involved in other companies where there was investment dollars and there was debt incurred. And I don't know, sometimes I think you don't work as hard, or maybe you're not as smart when in the back of your mind, there's some cash available to you, right? But there wasn't. I didn't have any cash available to me. So I had to be really smart about my decisions. I couldn't waste a dime. And I encourage entrepreneurs today who might be looking for cash to try to see if they can do it without the cash infusion. If you can figure out how to make it work without an investor or without debt, you're going to be in a better position down the line.
My God,
Absolutely.
that's really powerful, because as I'm going through work or going through the things that I do on a daily basis and working with other entrepreneurs, they're always thinking, okay, if we had this much cash, we could do this much more. But you're absolutely right. When you work as a bootstrap model, you think much more efficiently. You're not as lazy. Let me just say that, and
Yes.
might offend some people, but when you have that cash infusion, you become a little lazy, you become a little complacent, as opposed to when you don't have it and you've got to meet ends meet. I
Yeah,
love that, man.
definitely. Definitely.
So, Tom, you've built the company, but you also build a ton of relationships. Talk to me about what role did relationships and trust play in your success in making this company a reality?
That's a good question. Relationships are important to me. I tend to be I'm firm, but I'm not like super tough as an entrepreneur. I try to get to know the people that I work with. There's give and take in all business relation, well, in all relationships, not just business relationships. But I try to recognize that I would not say that I'm the greatest like negotiator in the world. I might sometimes give up too much. I think in some ways that's benefited me because then people like to work with me. And I think there's a lot to be said for being in a relationship where both sides like to work with each other. If you don't like to work with somebody, well, you're not going to work as hard for them. You're not going to go to bat for them. So, I think sometimes it's not good to be too tough and to over negotiate and demand too much
Agreed.
because then your vendor or your contractor might not be as interested in working with you long term. So I didn't recognize that about myself early on, and then I recognized that's just the kind of person I am, and I decided that's who I want to be. I want to be the kind of contractor, vendor, customer, owner who people like to work with.
I like that. There's only so much time in this world, though. Why not work where you're enjoying your time and the other people as well, as opposed to being in this heightened, tense state? And nobody likes that. And you, we, in our conversation earlier, you're a currently a brand new empty nester, as you had mentioned, right?
Yes.
And when we're raising kids, there are tense times when the kids aren't doing the thing they were supposed to, right? And then you're like, hey, I'm not having a good time. Well, the kids are not having a good time either. Let's go back to some mistakes and that most first time authors or entrepreneurs make when entering the publishing space. What are those, and how can somebody resolve them? Or even know to look for them.
That's a great question. So, the publishing industry is complex. It's more complex, I think, than meets the eye, than people think it is. Because it seems easy to self-publish your book these days. It seems easy to publish your book. A lot of people do it because it seems easy. But it's not. It's never as easy as it looks. So, authors who are self-publishing, they make a lot of run-of-the-mill mistakes that you shouldn't make, but they don't know they're making the mistakes until it's too late. So it's very common actually. And like one mistake that you make with a book can really can kill the project, and the book is dead on arrival. And I see a lot of self-published books that I call DOA books. They're dead on arrival. They made critical mistakes in either how they wrote the book, how the book was packaged, designed, titled, distributed. One small mistake in one of those areas really hurts a book's opportunity to sell well. And you don't know that until it's too late, oftentimes. And I will also I suggest to authors who self-publish, and I'm a proponent of self-publishing. I don't think it's sometimes it's the best way to do it, but you have to be prepared for success also. If a book begins to be successful, and it's let's say a book starts to sell tens of thousands of copies, are you prepared for that? Do you know what to do in those instances? Are you prepared to print 50,000 books? Do you have the cash to print 50,000 books, for example, or 100,000 books? And how would you go about doing that? How would you warehouse those books? How would you distribute and fulfill those books? There's so many questions, or there's so many issues that arise when a project does become successful. And if you're not prepared to deal with that, then also that would destroy a book's opportunity or chances to sell well if the author doesn't understand all the decisions and the things that might come into play with a successful book project. Even publishers struggle with successful books. I've been involved in projects where we blew through 50,000 books very quickly.
Wow.
Well, what do you do then? Do you print another 50,000 books? Books are returnable. Maybe
That's true.
the retailers are going to return those 50,000 books.
Yeah.
At what point do you know when to print more books? So these are all complicated questions.
Yeah, very
And
complicated ones for
if you
sure.
don't have experience in the industry, you wouldn't know how to think about it.
That's such a powerful one. And when Pat Flynn published his book, the latest one, Lean Publishing or Lean Learning, he was telling us that they ran out of books. I'm like, how can you run out of books? Doesn't Amazon offer on-demand printing? It's like, yes, they do, but when you go through a publisher, you have
Right.
to, allocate a certain amount and then, make sure that you can fulfill on that and everything. So talk to me about, we were talking about self-publishing, but then how does that work if you're going the Amazon route and doing print on demand?
Yeah, and print on demand is a great solution. And I've used print on demand for many, many books over the years. It is a good solution. It's not a perfect solution. It's definitely not a perfect solution for a book that begins to sell very well, because the print on demand fulfillment, they're not going to be able to keep up. At some point, somebody's going to need to order a lot of books because the books can sell very quickly. Sometimes a book will take off and sell thousands of copies overnight. The print on demand systems aren't good enough, they're not efficient enough to deal with that. So then you do need to print books. The problem is you don't know how many books to print. And this is the struggle that every publisher has. With your friend who ran out of books, then the publisher has to decide, well, how many more books should we print? Should we print 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, 100,000? They don't want to lose money by printing overprinting. They also don't want to lose money by not printing enough. So that takes some experience to know and understand what the break-even point is going to be and when you're risking enough but not too much.
That's a powerful insight, Tom. Thank you so much. Now, the episode title, so every time I have somebody come on, I ask them, "Hey, what would you like your episode to be titled?" And your title is bold: How to Write a Book When AI is Forcing Authors to Become More Human. I love that tension. Let's dig in. What's happening in the world of publishing right now? We're in 2025, and just so people listening in the future, they kind of like, okay, when does this episode come out? Talk to me about what's happening in the world of publishing right now.
Definitely. AI is clearly impacting the world of publishing in ways that are still unpredictable, I would say, because it's moving so fast. I'm seeing more and more manuscripts that are written by AI. I would say 6 months ago, I saw very few. Now it's becoming fairly common as more writers understand how to use AI to write books. I can usually spot it pretty early on if a book was written by AI. So that's a problem because the reader can spot it as well. Now, if you're really proficient at using AI and you're experienced with it, I think it's much harder to know that it was written by AI. But a lot of people are just jumping in and using it, in a fairly amateur way to write their book. So I think readers are going to spot that very easily, and I think that'll be a problem for readers. I think it'll be a problem for those books. That's not to say that you shouldn't use AI. It's a great tool, and it can be super helpful as in terms of writing a book. And if you are good at using it, understand how to use it wisely, it can be super helpful. And I do believe that it's going to cause another explosion of books. We've already seen an explosion over the last 10 years that's going to increase and probably rapidly. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? I don't think it's a bad thing, but I do think it's going to force the writer, the author, to be very wise and prudent in how they use it. The one thing AI doesn't know is your story.
No.
it knows a lot about a lot of things, and it
Yeah.
can output the information very quickly, but it doesn't know who you are. And even if you tell it who you are, it's only still has limited insight. So I think this is where the human aspect of it becomes very important.
Yeah.
You still need to inject yourself into that book because only you knows you, and only you has experienced your life.
Yes.
Only you have had the conversations with other people. AI doesn't know about that either. So you have to, in a prudent way, inject yourself into these words that you're getting from AI. If you can do that, then I think it's magic. I think that, in that way, you could write a compelling book, a very powerful book. But if you're just giving AI prompts and it's spitting out content, it might be well written because it is well written.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's too perfect, I would say. The writing's too perfect. Sometimes it needs a little human
It doesn't have the flaws.
imperfection injected into the book.
I love that because the more, plus it's just it's so AI is not even intelligent in this way that it's literally spitting out patterns that it's trained on. Whereas when we speak as human beings, we come from a concerted effort, like we put thoughts together based on how we understand and how we learn, and the more we use our humanness into writing the content that we're writing, it makes more sense because you put an actual intelligence as opposed to a pattern recognition, deduplication. That's why they call it, generative prompt transformation or generative, what's the P stand for? I forgot. But yeah, it's a transformer, right? It's a transformer on data that it already has. You mentioned that you're like a lot of manuscripts that you're getting are, generated by AI. Are you seeing more as more them? Are you seeing them as templated, or are they, like, how are they stacking up between those ways that they come together?
I mean, that's a good question. Some of them are. Again, it's so easy to do. So because it's easy to do, you just see more people, using it in that way. So the manuscripts that I see that are not written with AI, they need more work. They need more editorial work for sure. The manuscripts that are written by AI, they need less copy editing. They need almost no copy editing, honestly. The copy editing's perfect. The grammar's perfect. The spelling's perfect. All of that's perfect. Whereas the books written by humans have all sorts of problems, from a grammatical, sentence structure standpoint, they need more work. But even though they need more work, they're probably better books than the books written by AI, unless you know what you're doing. So, and but I think this is all so unpredictable where it's headed
It
because,
is.
I mean, from my perspective, AI is getting better by the day, right? So
It
I
is.
saw all this, and by the time this podcast airs, it might not even be accurate anymore. That's what I,
Yes.
it's completely unpredictable.
It is. It is. Now you mentioned about the copy's perfect for AI generated content. Not a lot of work needs to be due. What makes a book feel human in the age of content overload? Because we're getting a ton of transcripts. How do you add the human back into this content?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. I mean, in some ways, imperfection might be more valuable now. A book that has imperfections and isn't so perfect. I don't mean words spelled wrong. I just mean it sounds more like a person would sound, like you and I are talking right now. We're not worried about our words being perfect, right? So I think the books that are that way might be more better received by readers. I think that you also probably need to think more carefully about making your book more unique to you. I'm a big believer now that the niche books sell better than the more generic books, right? The more
Yeah.
niche, the better, the stronger the book. But the more niche the book, that means it's more unique to you and your own experiences. So that means you're going to have to work on getting that out of your brain onto into the computer, because AI
Yeah,
can't
yeah,
get
yeah.
into your brain. So yeah, so in that way, I think that the imperfections are important, and I think the more of you that you can inject in the book, then the book's going to have a better opportunity to sell well.
I love that. Well, Tom, let's get practical. And what would you say to the coach, creative, or founder listening right now who wants to write a book, but they feel overwhelmed? Because I remember when I was there and I was like, how would I write a book? And I had shared a story about having a chapter in a book. And they're like, hey, I only need 2,500 words. So what I did back then was I recorded 2.5 hours of audio while I was commuting back and forth from my work, which transcribed to 17,000 words. And the guy was like, are you looking to write your own book? We just need a chapter. So that's what I did, but what would you say to somebody listening? They want to write a book, but they're feeling overwhelmed. Where did they start?
It is overwhelming at first. You have to do really what you did. You have to break it down into smaller chunks, whether it's 2,500 words or 500 words. If you break it down into small chunks, then it's not so intimidating. Almost any of us can, well, think about how much writing we all do every day. I don't know how many words the average person writes in a day between text messages and emails, but it's a lot.
It
And you're
is.
not intimidated by that process. That's not hard. We do it all the time. So because it's broken down. So I think that's the most important thing, is to break it down into small chunks. You know, it took J.K. Rowling almost a decade to write the first Harry Potter book. I
No
broke that
way.
down one day. I don't remember what it is offhand, but it was something in the order of a couple hundred words a day. You know, now I'm sure that's not how she wrote it. She probably wrote it in larger chunks than
Spurts,
that.
yeah.
But you take that whole novel over a decade, it wasn't that many words each day. So when you break it down like that, it's not so intimidating.
I love that. Love that. You gotta break it down, take baby steps, eat an elephant, one bite at a time. Tom, I love that advice. Thank you. Now, what's the first step you advise when someone says, hey, I want to write a book, and you already mentioned to break it down, but let's say they've broken it down. What's the next step? Is there a format?
Not necessarily a format. I think that the next important step is to ask yourself, what is the reader going to get out of this book? Most people write a book based on their life experiences, which is great, but people don't care as much as you think they do about your life. What they're really looking for is answers and solutions. So most people start it from the standpoint of what they have experienced, but then you have to turn that. You have to look at it from the perspective of a reader, not from the perspective of the writer, and begin to ask yourself, what problems do I want to solve with this book? What questions do I want to answer? And how can my story help do those two things? You don't want to just write about your story. People care less than you think they do, to be completely honest. They want to know, they're in the middle of something. They want to know, how are you going to solve this problem for me? How are you going to help me solve this problem? So you have to look at it from that perspective. Don't look at it from the perspective of you, but from their perspective. And then you want to inject some of your story into that, but not too much, just enough. It's a bit of a tightrope walk, I would say. And some books will tell a lot more story than others. But I really believe the less story, the better in most times. You know, unless your story is absolutely incredible. And we've all experienced some neat stuff, but not many of us have been to the top of Mount Everest. So the reader is probably not going to care as much, but they might care deeply about how you figured out to solve the problem.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No, that's an excellent point. How are you solving the problem? Because they like the why that they saw on the cover. Now they want to resolve and figure out the how on the inside. Well, Tom, this conversation is just getting started because this was part one of our conversation. And in part two, we'll be diving into the publishing process, the power of legacy storytelling, and how authors can create a brand that transcends the book. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. This was absolutely amazing. I learned so much about publishing and the experience that people can have and what they can do to get started and create that manuscript that they've been waiting for. Tom, thank you so much. Where can folks connect with you and learn more to work with you?
Yeah, definitely. And thanks, Junaid, for having me on your program. It's been a lot of fun. People can visit my website, and it's simply, but I'll need to spell it, freilingagency.com. And Freiling
Perfect.
is FREILING, freilingagency.com. Or visit LinkedIn or Twitter. Just look for Tom Freiling in either of those places, and that might be simpler than going to the website.
Absolutely. We'll be sure to include the links to your website, your
Right.
LinkedIn, so folks can connect with you and connect with you and connect, and can you find what they're looking for or get you write that first book for
Excellent.
themselves.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks.
So, guys, stay tuned, follow, subscribe, and get ready for the next chapter. Make sure to visit and connect with Tom through the links that we have provided in the show notes, and we'll see you in part two. Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to Hacks and Hobbies. You can find additional information on the guest today on their website, hacksandhobbies.com. Please feel free to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on upcoming interviews with amazing guests.